Hello and welcome to another episode of LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard, and I am here with Josh Olswich. As you may know, Carpe Noctem on the internet. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Brian. How's it going?
Pretty good, man. How's it feel being back on the top side of the world?
Feels good. You know, you don't realize that A, New Zealand is a place, and B, it's like at the edge of the world. And there's like a city there, Auckland, and it's like any other city. Like people live there and do stuff. It's like, it's hilly. It rained the whole time I was there, but it's cool. It's an interesting place. Everyone's like super, super friendly as well. So if you're an American and you're thinking about going to New Zealand, like there's zero anti-American sentiment there at all. Everybody was super cool.
Yeah, New Zealand is very high on my list of places that I want to visit. So yeah. I'm jealous of your trip. Slightly glad that it rained on you. I'm just kidding. Sounds like you got a lot of work done, though.
Yeah, we busted out some articles, trying to do three a week for Brave New Coin. Trying to work on some smaller projects, too. It's always hard to like find research on smaller projects, let alone like push articles that don't sound like blatant like promotion. Advertisement, you know? Like, yeah. I just want to talk about cool articles. Like that Tokes article. I don't even smoke pot, but like they're doing cool stuff. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Well, I like what I've seen you put out. We're actually going to talk more in depth. And this has been kind of overarching on several of our conversations. So we figured we'd just go all in today and talk about decentralized exchanges, our questions and our basic understanding, which I think people will come to realize, like, we don't know a lot of the issues at hand. So maybe in a future episode, I'll actually interview some of the people involved with some of these exchanges and get their take on it. But we're going to have our primary topic about decentralized exchanges, kind of the lay of the land, what questions we have, our concerns about using them, that kind of thing. But before we get to that, we should get to the news. And the news of the week, in a big way, is going to be one that if you're into altcoins, you will either be excited about or potentially a little nervous. And I'll bring up my reasoning for that. But that was that Poloniex was acquired by Circle, which is a crypto startup, with backing from Goldman Sachs, which everyone's been talking about. Josh, can you start us off by saying what you know about Circle? Because I don't know a ton about Circle, but I know you've written about their influence a little bit.
Yeah, so Circle, the CEO, Jeremy Allaire, he put out this great article I pull up like once a year called Why Bitcoin Matters on like New York Times. I think he wrote it. That was like 2014 maybe. So he's been in Bitcoin stuff, crypto for a while. They took crypto. They were actually like a really great company to buy Bitcoin from back in the day, like 2015, I want to say. Kind of like where Cash App, the Square app, is now. If you haven't used that, by the way, it's huge. It's awesome. Like there's a little markup on the price itself, but there's no
Square
fees.
Square Cash.
Yeah, Square. It's called Cash App, but it's through Square. It's basically like the old Circle to me.
Yeah, it's kind of like Venmo as well.
Yeah, because at the time, Circle, like the prices were a little higher than Coinbase, but there were no fees. And I think they took credit cards even before Coinbase did. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But so they were in it for a while. Then they stopped taking Bitcoin, probably because they just didn't want to deal with regulatory stuff. Mm-hmm. They never sold Ethereum or anything like that. But they never fully got out of it either, because they had an OTC desk for a while now, over-the-counter stuff.
Yeah, I read that that was actually responsible for a whole lot of their revenue. Is they manage, I don't remember if there was a number, but it's like, if you want to buy a quarter million or more in Bitcoin, you can go there and buy over-the-counter and they'll facilitate the arrangement.
Yeah, they're out of Boston too, which is kind of a weird place for a fintech company, I think. I'm pretty sure they also have a New York Bit license as well. One of the three companies. So it's Coinbase, Circle, and Ripple are the three who actually have the license.
Yeah, my understanding is that they are one of the three with the Bit license, which has its own news going on.
It does. Yeah, we should talk about that too. But yeah, so like they've been in it. They've never really disappeared. Like everyone was super upset when they, including myself, when they said, you know, we're not going to deal with plebs anymore. We're only going to deal with people with money, basically. Mm-hmm. So then they kind of disappeared. And apparently Allaire said a while, like a year ago, that people aren't going to be using Bitcoin in 5 years.
Yeah.
I don't recall that. I saw some
Life Moves Fast style tweets.
Yeah.
Quoting him on that, which was probably out of context in some way or another. But
Probably, because like I said, he wrote that article, Why Bitcoin Matters, back a while back. Is he the one? No, that's Mark Andreessen. I always confuse those two, because Mark Andreessen doesn't have a Twitter. But
he used to in a big way.
I'm not sure if he's on Circle. Is he on the Circle team too?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I feel like I'm having the faces in my head are switched.
They may be backers, so, but yeah, I did double check. They're trading $2 billion a month over the counter. So
yeah, the guy at the Consensus Invest conference, the OTC guy, was like super bullish on alts in general. That was the day before they announced their basically Robinhood type retail app where they are going to let people buy and sell altcoins, it looks like, directly.
Yeah, Robinhood is.
Circle Invest is what it's called, but they haven't released it yet.
And there was another part of the alts thing with Robinhood. And then I want to ask about the Circle acquisition because of the regulatory stuff. One of my concerns might be actually that Poloniex might delist a whole bunch of coins. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so they started, last year Bittrex sold all their market share that was valuable, in my opinion. You know, there are a few people still using it. There was so much FUD about Polo last year that I still hear about from people who are in the know, by the way, mm-hmm. and are like, you know, be careful. But they're fine now, apparently, because they obviously got acquired. So there's on the up and up in some respect. But, you know, their support wasn't keeping up with demand. Their exchange wasn't keeping up with demand. As was, you know, nobody was keeping up with demand last year at all. But most everybody went to Bittrex. Then they started piling on additional KYC AML stuff, which probably was the first sign that they were trying to, you know, be above board in mm-hmm. the regulatory sense, because they've obviously done some stuff in the past that apparently got grandfathered in because they're not going to, what it sounded like based on what people were saying, that if Circle's involved now, that the regulatory bodies aren't going to go after Poloniex for anything they've done.
Yeah.
You know, the sins of the past or whatever.
Nathaniel Popper from the New York Times got sent one of the slides from, a confidential Circle presentation where Circle briefed the SEC and the SEC basically indicated that they wouldn't pursue, and I'm quoting quasi from this deck, wouldn't pursue enforcement action for prior activity. And also the SEC noted that Circle was the only company to actually approach them, so that they were progressive on working closely with Circle.
Maybe that explains the low sale, like 400 million. Like we've seen ICOs that are bigger than that.
but it's a get out of jail free card for Poloniex for sure. If they had potential liability. And even if it's not like, oh, people are going to get fined or go to jail, if nothing else, like it was potential to have years worth of, regulatory bodies down your neck. So if this gets you out of a lot of that or puts it in the hands of people better equipped to deal with it, then mm-hmm. 400 million plus getting out of all your past is pretty great. So I thought that was a really interesting angle. And I still think 400 millions, the way you evaluate a company is not based on what you've done in the past. It's how it looks like you'll do in the future. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Polo now is two generations behind basically in the altcoin market because people moved to Bittrex and then people moved to Binance. So getting 400 million for something where people really don't have an appetite for going back to is not the worst thing in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't know Tristan at all. He's like the top of the chain, I think, at Polo. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if I were him, I would say, I'll cash in my chips here, you know.
Yeah.
Let somebody else take the reins. Let somebody else deal with scalability, support, competition, market share, blah, blah, blah.
So one of the issues that was brought up by a lawyer that I follow was about how the SEC's take on basically so many ICOs are actually securities. And if they're cooperating. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's
and if,
great.
If they're cooperating with the SEC, then will Circle just delist everything just about? So Circle's over-the-counter things that they support are Bitcoin, Ethereum, ETC, Zcash, Bitcoin Cash, Litecoin, Neo, and Qtum, which some of those are ICO'd. So I don't necessarily think everything that's ever ICO'd is going to be delisted, but I do think Circle will probably say, all right, we're not playing around here anymore. Like all of your favorite garbage coins with super low liquidity and all these other things, I would be nervous about those. So like, I'm approaching this in the sense of being a little more cautious about which altcoins I'm willing to throw my chips in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's two sides to that. Are they actually going to delist anything? I think they might. I think there's a high chance they'll delist something. But at the same time, like, what are the odds that that coin is delisted everywhere? Probably not zero. So
yeah.
What is the impact of Poloniex at this point in time? I don't know. I know when Vox got delisted and something else got delisted at that time, those dumped pretty hard.
Yeah. A delisting definitely causes a coin to dump, but they also rebound pretty well.
It's Poloniex, so.
Yeah. So we'll see the effect on that. I do think
it'll be harder to list stuff. I definitely think that. Just like it is harder to list things on Bittrex now, which is why these other exchanges have popped up, like KuCoin and God knows what else, who just basically list everything.
Yeah. And I think as we move forward, the coins that Robinhood supports, the coins that Circle supports, Circle, Poloniex, I don't know if they'll rebrand. I think they should.
It's Circloniex.
I mean, Circloniex.
That's pretty much final.
The coins that they support, I think it will give them a leg up in those coins in terms of legitimacy, just because you know that there's been a lot more due diligence put onto the type of stuff they're willing to participate with, you know?
Yeah, and I can't remember if DCG, Digital Currency Group, is in the mix with Circle or not.
I don't see angel investors when I am looking on who was part of their Series A through D rounds. But they do have a lot of, there were 11 investors in their $60 million round. Goldman Sachs was part of a $50 million Series C round.
Goldman probably is like, you know, nothing in name only in my mind, you know, it's like, who knows how much money they have in Circle.
Yeah.
That's neither here nor there. They also want to set up a crypto desk for trading Goldman. So this probably fulfills some of that as well. I don't know. Like, it provides liquidity for their Circle Invest app. It plugs into Goldman if they want. With DCG, I was getting to is like, I don't know. Basically, you know, you have sway as to what stays or goes on the exchange, what gets listed, you know, very obviously very powerful person, owns CoinDesk-ish, owns part of Coinbase, I think.
And DCG is an investor in Circle from the Series B round.
Yeah, so you're probably going to see a lot of the same coins everywhere, you know, like Zeek. That's, you know, I can just see this coming because I see how DCG does their thing, good or bad.
Yeah.
That's what they do, you know.
In terms of the the Goldman angle, so they approached this differently than JP Morgan, who said, JP Morgan just kind of outright said Bitcoin is garbage or whatever, the CEO, the diamond route, whereas Goldman came out and said, actually in their, I think their quarterly report or whatever it was, talked about how blockchain and cryptocurrency to an extent is actually a risk to them. So the way I would say Goldman is approaching this is like they should, and like they do with a lot of things, is they notice the risk and diversify into it. So they're hedging with their investments into the whole ecosystem. So, you know, Goldman has their foot into everything, basically.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I would buy into all the hype about Circle basically being a Goldman puppet or whatever. But it is significant that we do have the major investment arm, you know, the premier investment company in the United States, has at least a hand in crypto now. So to me, that's bullish in the long run.
Crypto is such a small world. Like, even me talking about DCG in relation to who owns what, it's like DCG has their tentacles everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, people talk to each other. People have developed relationships with each other. So, you know, we're going to see ETC and Zeek get promoted in some way eventually by these platforms.
And then the final thing we'll see in terms of Polo here is this will essentially probably make, I would assume it would make Polo a safer place to trade in the future than some other altcoin exchanges, especially if you're an American and you're seeking full FDIC insurance, which Polo did not have. Bittrex did, I believe. I think that's true. But then, you know, the BitLicense and whatnot. Speaking of the BitLicense, another smaller news item, it looks like they are open to reviewing it. There's not a whole lot more to say.
Surprise, surprise.
Other than it'll probably be something we have to pay attention to for the foreseeable future, because for whatever reason.
If you're in New York, right?
Yeah, if you're in New York. But, you know, there's something to there are big players in New York that will take that seriously.
Yeah. So, I mean, so most people around the world, as they did with the BitLicense, they were like, you know, that's way too harsh. That's too burdensome. It's going to kill innovation. And it did. People went elsewhere. You know, people went to Panama, Eric Voorhees, a bunch of like random companies that were in New York left or just shut down. So,
yeah. So that's that. And we'll go into our final news item. Won't spend a lot of time on it, but there was a Reddit thread, I guess, is where this started, in terms of where it was discovered by crypto Twitter, at least. And that was a $10 billion lawsuit, or maybe a $5 billion lawsuit, really, filed by Dave Kleiman's estate. So I think it was filed by his brother, against Craig Wright. And this is a really in-depth document that I can link up in the show notes, going into all of these past emails. And the lawsuit essentially says that there are a million Bitcoins in Craig Wright's possession. Bitcoins. We're saying Bitcoin these days as plural, right? So it was essentially claiming that half of those Bitcoin are owed to Dave Kleiman's estate. Josh, do you, can you give a TLDR on Dave Kleiman and kind of this whole thing? I had to read up more about it to confirm what I understood about his history in addition to Craig Wright's history. And then we'll get into why people thought this was significant.
From what I remember, he was some sort of business partner at some point in time with Craig Wright. I don't know if that's correct or not, but
yeah. So they had a joint venture.
Yeah. I remember hearing about this story maybe a few years ago, even when, even before he came out and said, I'm Satoshi Nakamoto. I think there was something in the news at that time about like just the crazy connections, like he died or you know, I don't remember what happened, like under suspicious circumstances or something. Like there's just some weirdness there. Not that it's like a conspiracy theory or anything, but.
Yeah, no, I think the conspiracy theory element was pretty off base. In fact, I think there was at least one Twitter account that got suspended for insinuating it.
Yeah.
But it does appear at least that Dave Kleiman and Craig Wright. So Dave Kleiman was technical and a very smart guy and interested in this space before Bitcoin existed or around the time Bitcoin existed. The assumption was that Dave Kleiman and Craig Wright were early miners. However, based on the way this law complaint was written, really gave some potential merit to Craig Wright actually having a claim on being a portion of Satoshi, basically, was what the takeaway was, until it was roundly and fully disputed by WizSec, who I don't know if he has a name attached, does he? I don't think
so. If I were him, I wouldn't have a name attached.
Yeah. Anyway, so the WizSec blog basically said the Kleiman versus Craig Wright suit was a suit, is a suit about Bitcoins that never were.
Same day they announced.
Yeah, he brought this out fast and with furiously with pretty damning evidence, because he did. So he's a known, very qualified security researcher, blockchain researcher. He did a lot of work that you're familiar with, right, Josh, about the Mt. Gox hack and those addresses. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't done anything. And how long did you say? Like a year or two that since he's actually really written about anything?
I don't think it's been a year, maybe 6 months since the Mt. Gox BTCE stuff came out.
Okay. But
I mean, somebody went to jail based on the work that he did. So,
yeah. So he published these exhibits and, basically said the Bitcoin that is referenced in the lawsuit, which is mostly from Craig Wright claiming he had stakes in this stuff, basically none of it belongs to Craig Wright, or so much of it does not belong that the likelihood is that he owns nowhere close to a million Bitcoin. So the WizSec guy looks like he totaled up 650,000 plus Bitcoin that mostly go back to old Mt. Gox wallets and other powerful people in the crypto space that you've heard their names. so it looks like there were objections to some of those actual listings. Like some of them were, I think they were to Jed McCaleb and, you know, some other people that are
Roger Ver.
Roger Ver, yeah. So he received objections, and then he now has changed all of them to just say unknown. Although I wouldn't put it past the accuracy of the previous list.
Well, I saw, you know, the lawsuit came out, and I immediately rolled my eyes. Number one.
Yeah.
Then I looked at like the amount of money that was on the lawsuit. It was like, yeah, that's never gonna happen. And then of course, you know, Craig Wright, who's in my mind just the con man evidence keeps adding up over time.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I'm not surprised that he's continuously involved in some sort of litigation for something. I think the only thing with him that is legitimate is he has some sort of vault that opens like 2021 or something with some massive amount of Bitcoin in it. I think that's actually legitimate, but I could be wrong there. I don't know if you remember hearing about that or not.
Yeah, it wouldn't. I don't know why it would be closed off until 2021.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't remember like the circumstances. I just remember hearing about it. Yeah. So
it doesn't surprise. It won't surprise me that he actually does have a lot of Bitcoin. I'll put it that way. It seems like he legitimately was an early miner. And then over the years has probably done other things to increase his potential in terms of ability to gain Bitcoin, including in this lawsuit. It really does look like one of the things he did was just essentially scam his former business partner's dad, I think, is who he sent.
Yeah, he sent the email to his 94-year-old parents or something. It was just like, oh, Jesus, this is like classic old people who don't know any better. You know, it's like when you the telemarketers call like your grandparent with dementia and get him to sign up for like some scam insurance or something like that. That's what immediately reminded me of, like taking advantage of these people.
Yeah. And essentially, it seems like he was basically just trying to get him to hand over the private keys from the wallet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there were things that written in there, probably backdated emails and whatnot. But still, like it at first glance, it was like there were a lot of people that were like, holy crap. Like, is he really Satoshi? And, you know, personally, I said, like, if he is, I'll be really, really sad.
Yeah.
So the WSSEC article essentially concluded that more than him potentially being Satoshi, it was probably just some guy, quote, browsing a blockchain rich list, picking out a couple of addresses at random, saying I own those for whatever reasons, and then, you know, going off to try to scam someone. So his conclusion was don't trust Verify, which then with what I would say a power move, Nick Szabo tweeted that article and quoted the, while the lawsuit is a nonsensical fight over unrelated funds that never belonged to either party, it offers the rest of us a valuable reminder, don't trust, Verify. And that was pretty much all I needed to see personally. because we know that Nick Szabo was involved early. And while we don't know if or if not he is or was part of Satoshi, that doesn't matter as much. He probably knows enough to determine whether or not Craig Wright has any real claim. So
I think the real Satoshi like saw his initials, Nick Szabo, and like searched Google for like some anime character and like figured out like Satoshi Nakamoto. Like that's honestly what I believe. But anyway.
Maybe so. Either way,
we're
not gonna overly speculate on the real Satoshi. But we can go back to generally believing that it's not Craig Wright.
Yeah.
At least that's what I'll do.
Yeah. I mean, the evidence, like I said, keeps mounting.
Right.
So,
one question that I've been getting this week, because I tweeted, about how I'm essentially considering some things that mm-hmm. Bitcoin has reminded me of in this run. So I've been considering discrepancies between, we're moving into some technical stuff, discrepancies between simple and exponential moving averages, linear versus log trends, various settings on the Ichimoku cloud, and also paying more attention to volume profiles as well as linear support precision. So when I'm essentially drawing what my linear supports are. I said that because of the moves that we've been seeing in Bitcoin, the sensitivity to small moves, I guess. So like, mm-hmm. I can't be as lazy when Bitcoin is trying to fight out of a downtrend. Like it's not, when you're in a sustained uptrend, I can just be a little more lazy, you know? So I wrote this in response to that, or as a culmination of my thoughts. So I wanted to ask you, like, what are your general thoughts about how you use different indicators and Do you think I'm being silly and essentially second guessing or trying to poke holes in my normal tooling?
Right. One other last thing. So JPM put out an annual report sometime last week, I think. Mm-hmm. And they mentioned cryptocurrencies as competition on the banner paragraph. So that's pretty interesting.
GPM?
JP Morgan. Just to put a bow on the whole like banking stuff. So indicators. I personally don't think the stuff matters too much. Like the cloud settings, for example, like it doesn't matter what your cloud settings are. What matters more is that they capture a high amount of data. Mm-hmm. In my mind.
And how you read those.
Right. So everyone like freaks out when I use like singled settings sometimes. But the big thing is you have to realize what the indicator is telling you. More often than not, you want to capture as much data as you can with the indicator, which isn't always a good thing with altcoins because they're new or they're all over the place. But the older the coin, I want some high time frame, high data capture stuff like doubled cloud, even doubled back D. Doubling your oscillators is another thing that I haven't really played around too much with, but Rob Booker, the person who I got the doubled cloud idea from, he doubles oscillators as well, MACD, RSI. Hmm. So there's some credence there to people who've done this much longer than I have. As far as like SMA versus EMA versus TEMA or whatever, I don't, for me, that like doesn't really matter. I don't know. Maybe it's because I have a relationship with certain indicators and I expect to see certain things a certain way. Like when I see EMA cross, like I know what that means just based on what I've seen in the past. So I, you know, recall all that information in my head and just say, okay, that's, I can trust this. I know what this means. It's in some degree helps me, you know, predict the future, even though, you know, past results don't predict future results.
Yeah.
So when I start playing around with like EMA values or which EMA, SMA, EMA, TMA, whatever.
Right.
I don't really know how to read that, you know, like if the EMA disagrees with the MA, what do I do? You know,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And I do agree. And I think this was the culmination of when you talked to, I think, John Bollinger about Bollinger band settings as well. Mm-hmm. One of the things is how well can you read the one that you use,
right?
More so than what other setting disagrees with your settings or whatever.
Right.
And I do. I think there's a lot of merit to that. The one of the primary things that made me ask myself this question was when, especially during the dump, the SMA 200 captured the bottom better than the EMA 200 did, mm-hmm. and it seemed like a couple of the breakdowns worked really well off of SMAs with the 50 and the 100. Like the way they hovered, and then when they dumped, they worked pretty well off SMAs versus EMAs. Mm-hmm. And then we're seeing it a little bit right now with linear versus log and this downtrend line that I feel like the whole world is paying attention to. So downtrend line being from mid-December and trying to essentially break this downward trajectory. And we've now seen four times the Bitcoin price has essentially bounced off the linear trend, while the two most recent in log, it never really quite reached them. So my conclusion there was essentially that I should at least know where the linear trend exists. And that's kind of where I finalized my thoughts, I guess, because if you're looking at log, this right shoulder that's formed or whatever you want to call it, like this, this part of the up move from 6,000, mm-hmm. it paused twice now on the linear trend, where on the log trend, it's not gotten there. So that's kind of why I mentioned that, even though on the whole, I'm way more in favor of log trends because they kind of, like you mentioned earlier, capturing data, they show a lot more data on something that's increased in price a great deal. So, because mm-hmm. if you were looking at the Bitcoin price before 2017, it all looks like a flat line unless you're in log. So that's the very basic reasoning why I like log, is because it gives me more data.
Yeah. Something I talked about a lot in Auckland was how market participants are changing. So in my mind, I just feel like there's a groundswell of institutional people coming. So that could mean, and there's like some small things I've noticed that where indicators aren't acting the way they have been in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think this is part of like this, you know, connects with what you're talking about, that things may need to be changed based on that. You know, we're not, this isn't like retail heaven anymore. It's like, you know, the big boys are here. It's a lot like Forex. It's getting to the point where it's a lot like Forex in the respect that things are weirder.
Yeah.
Not as straightforward. Seeing a lot of what's called a Judas type candle, where it goes in one direction and then just completely reverses. Mm-hmm. Seeing that fairly often now.
Fake out, breakout
type stuff. I don't really recall that happening nearly as much as it is now. I've noticed like different time frames even are showing different things. Maybe it's just because I'm watching them more. I don't know, but the 6 hour or the 12 hour seem to be doing more signaling to me than the daily. Even like the 2 day and 3 day on certain charts are looking like they're saying more stuff to me than the daily. So
yeah, I've been paying a lot of attention to the 6 hour, 12 hour and daily. And I've noticed, mm-hmm. I've noticed myself, falling away more from the 4 hour, which I've essentially used since I got into crypto.
Yeah, I agree.
And the 6 hour is almost fully surpassed the 4 hour to me. I still look at things on a lot of time frames, especially if I'm looking for low time frame movement. But even when I look at altcoins, which have a lot more whipping around going on just because they're less liquid and they're so responsive to Bitcoin, Bitcoin's got a lot better data on those low time frames. Mm-hmm. So moving to the 6 hour on altcoins rather than the 4 hour is kind of my lowest time frame I really care to look at. I've also found to be fairly valuable. So I'm becoming a 6 hour convert. And I kind of
curve fit things in a way to like, so the MAs or the cloud, I'm always looking for something that looks like that you have up on your screen, where it's a sustained trend in one direction or the other. And then it starts to flatten out. Mm-hmm. Because then I know what those signals mean. I can use those signals.
Right.
But using, you know, picking a time frame, using it and sticking to it are getting a lot more cloudy to me.
Yeah.
As in unclear, which is why I think I've been using chart patterns a lot more. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just because we're in like a micro downtrend. I don't know. But chart patterns, like the inverted head and shoulders that brought us out of 6,000, the falling wedge that brought us from 8 to 10 or whatever it was, 9 to 11K. Mm-hmm. Chart patterns, if anything, have been definitely bumped up on my list of things I'm watching for and looking for.
Yeah, I've been looking at a lot of chart patterns in combination with RSI as well, just classical RSI. I've found the Stoke RSI to be really not as valuable lately. Whereas especially in the uptrend, it's like, it almost felt like, man, when that 30-minute Stoke bottomed, you were almost due for a good candle, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but we're also not in a real uptrend yet.
That's my point. It's like,
yeah.
In an indecision market is what I would call it, because we're still in a downtrend, but we've recovered by a great deal from the bottom. Mm-hmm. So we've entered the zone of indecision, which I would call anything really 8K to 12K maybe. And I think we'll see this come soon if we do break the linear downtrend or the log, you know, the downtrend line, whether you're in linear or log, there will be a lot of screaming bulls that if they try to go long or something and expect quick retests of all-time highs, I think they might be in for some pain. So I'm really considering it indecision territory. Not that it's untradeable. I think it's actually pretty fun to trade. But indecision territory, anywhere 8 to 12,000, and you could argue until we break the all-time high, even though you're really limiting your trade opportunities if you're waiting until we hit 20,000 again before you do anything with Bitcoin.
Yeah, I agree. We spent 2 weeks in this zone or order block on the left shoulder, mm-hmm. if you want to call it a shoulder. And it's only been like 12 days-ish in the right shoulder. So when we got back into this zone, I wasn't expecting it to blow past that, you know, the history that it's had. This is really the only history it's ever had up here besides the first time on the way up.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that it's sort of chilling here.
Yeah. And on the way up, it was I remember it very clearly. I mean, the volatility was enormous over the course mm-hmm. of several days, where we just went on a huge uptrend and then we bounced all over the place. And at the time, it was really mostly around the 10K psychological zone. But then we established these new areas like 11.8 was a big one. And, you know, these things that we just bounced upon. And then as we went into euphoria was when we broke through those. So this block 8 to 12K, I feel like is extremely significant, and people could really get chopped up in here, basically.
Yeah. The linear log thing real quick.
Yeah.
I like log a lot better. I'm probably never going to use linear.
Yeah.
Even though I like switch like on accident, sometimes it's on linear and I'm like, whatever. But I don't know. You know, I can't speak out of both sides of my mouth and say like things are changing, but I'm never going to look at linear.
Right.
So we'll see. We'll see. But log is where it's at for me.
Yeah. Anyway. There are times where I find linear interesting, if nothing else.
Yeah.
An additional one is, I think if I had gone into more dollar pairs, especially with altcoins in January, gone into more dollar pairs and not Bitcoin pairs and hit linear to just see just how much alts bounced off of Bitcoin falling from the all-time high, but not dying. Mm-hmm. I would have taken profits much more had I've really given that thought, because alts overextended themselves massively against the dollar. And we're essentially seeing a long and painful return to the mean with alts versus dollar pairs, I think, right now. And that's mm-hmm. That's why we're seeing this, I don't know what you'd call it, kind of a dead zone for altcoins while Bitcoin figures itself out. So, you know, there are times where I think linear can help you screw your head back on straight.
One last thing about the 12-hour cloud. I've never seen price hug the inside of the cloud like that for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It's super weird.
Yeah, I thought that was...
I don't know what that means, but it's just like... crazy. The alt thing,
can you describe that for audio only listeners, because it entered the cloud on the 12 and then it stayed in the cloud but sank in it, right?
Yeah. So typically when you see resistance on the outside of the cloud, mm-hmm. so it'll, you know, if the cloud is like curved, it'll like eerily creep up or creep down the cloud. Whether that's tradable is whatever, but it's just interesting to see how it draws the cloud 30 periods ahead, and then when it approaches the cloud, it respects the levels that were drawn at the time.
Yeah.
In this case, it breached the cloud and is just like falling down on the inside of the cloud. That's just really strange.
Yeah.
I don't know how to read that. It's just really weird.
It's almost offering support yet falling like crazy. Right.
Yeah. It's I don't know. It's just weird stuff going on.
This is one of those scenarios that I just look at it and I'm like, man, how did the cloud manage this? Even though it's strange looking, it's still following something that was drawn well ahead, because it's, yeah, you know, it's an advanced indicator. And now it's following it as if it was a pre-written path for the price that whole time. So even though it's strange behavior for the cloud, it's the type of thing I look at and like, man, makes me a cloud believer.
Makes me a settings believer.
A settings believer. Because this is Carpe Noctem settings that I'm on right now.
Well, really, it's like this guy from back in the day, settings, who I stole and they became mine. But
I thought you were going to punch me through the computer when I told you I was playing with some different settings, not even the traditional ones, but I was trying to in my process of questioning everything and just trying to like question my assumptions, what I look at. I was looking over the traditional settings and your settings and saying, well, why is it 10 and not 14? If the whole point is based on moving to a 24/7 market, because the original settings of 918, whatever, or not, you know what I mean? 926.
Yeah. 2652. Yeah.
The whole point of it being 9 was it was a little less than 2 weeks. So 10 is a little bit less than 2 weeks. So I was like, well, why don't we make this a clean 2 weeks, make it 1430. And I think it does get back to what you said earlier, is like, it doesn't matter as long as you can read it, because when I turned it on, it was really not that much different either. It, you know, it's all preference stuff.
And yeah, it's very subtle, very subtle. If you listen to the Chaos Trader, the cloud guy that I learned from, his thing on YouTube, he was describing the differences between doubled and singled. And I disagreed with everything he had to say, which is fine, but he is used to reading, traditional settings singled. That's just in like, I can see that the way he's describing things, which is fine. It's for him. And if he makes money with singled traditional settings on crypto, whatever, I don't care, you know. Mm-hmm. Just for me, that's just not how it doesn't work for me as well as these settings. So
yeah,
it's whatever. Like it really doesn't matter.
And you can find value in whatever you become comfortable with.
Right.
With singled settings, I actually, sometimes if I'm just looking to figure out like, okay, when should I add to this bag? Or if I'm looking to take off of it high, so like I'm not essentially waiting to stop out, I'm trying to capture as much of the top as I can. Mm-hmm. I might turn on singled settings and plan to sell as soon as it breaches the Tinkin, you know, like you can just figure out a way, things like that, that will allow you to do what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And that's why I have to turn on the fractal stops, because the doubled setting TK crosses are
typically too slow. Yeah, they're way too slow.
You just lose too much of the 80% of the trend that you want to capture. So
yeah. And I would say that's another thing that I've learned in this whole downtrend is capturing 80% of the trend. Although that sounds easy, it's still relatively hard when you have highly volatile assets. Capturing 50% of the trend is probably easier. But when you capture 50% of a trend that you saw 100% of course, that can be a little disappointing sometimes, because you feel like you really didn't take advantage of the full trend. So when people say like, well, I don't want to catch 80%, I want to catch the whole trend, I would actually rebut that and say 80% of the trend is pretty good. You've done well.
Yeah, I'm okay with hitting, you know, doubles and triples instead of a home run every once in a while.
Yeah. So let's finish up by talking about what was our primary topic, and that's decentralized exchanges. You wrote an article about the 0x protocol and the 0x project, but decentralized exchanges, as we've discussed before, they're going to be a bigger part of the ecosystem, and it seems like in some ways that's advancing quickly, I guess, but in others the same old problems exist. So can you talk in your mind, maybe with what you learned, and then also just why you think we need them in general?
Yeah. So basically, these hacks on exchanges are unsustainable. And what it comes down to is giving your private keys to somebody. Your coins are now on their ledger. They have control. If they get hacked, you're done. You know, this happens in Mt. Gox. This happens for Bitfinex. This happens for CoinCheck. All these other exchanges, there's a list on the ZRX article I posted, but unless that got removed, that might have got removed.
I've noticed. I've noticed recently that there have been exchange hacks that have hardly made the news.
And they're millions of dollars,
millions or tens of millions, you know, lots and lots of money at stake, and it's now so expected almost that aside from people who were affected by it, it hardly makes a blip in terms of the broader news cycle or much less price.
Yeah. And it just continues to happen. So there's that issue. And the question is, how do we solve that issue? How do you feel more comfortable trading with your funds on an exchange? So either you have to trust the exchange. So that removes like just the decentralized aspect to some degree, which is like counter crypto, basically. You know, crypto is all about decentralization of everything. You just have to trust everything about it, you know.
Either trust or spread out.
Right, trust or trust multiple.
Yeah.
Sort of like decentralize your funds in some way.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, for, I guess, disclosure purposes, that's basically my strategy. In order to be able to keep a significant portion of my overall account tradable without making myself liable to one exchange, and if it is the next victim, then I lose everything. My solution to that is to trade everywhere, basically.
Yeah, and there's things beyond just regular custodial risk. There's regulatory risk if you're in a country like China, even in the United States. You know, like the Polo thing could have went down a lot differently. They could have just said, which they basically did. You know, if you don't AML KYC AML by a certain day, your account's just closed. So, like, what are you gonna do? You know?
Yeah.
So how do we solve all these problems?
Right.
And the answer has been there for a long time. It's basically you keep your keys and we figure out a way to trade with a wallet that you have control of. In this case, hardware wallets, which is a genius solution, I think. So basically you're plugging in your hardware wallet to the exchange that says in an escrow form, basically, that you have control of X amount of funds through this wallet. And then you can trade peer-to-peer directly. Yeah. General issues with decentralized exchanges have been liquidity primarily. There just aren't enough people using it because centralized exchanges, as cumbersome, burdensome, issuesome, whatever as they've been, they haven't shifted the conversation for everybody over to use decentralized exchanges.
Yeah.
And then another issue with the ones that are popping up now is like Ether, Delta, Radar, Relay. The order book is to some degree on chain, so you have to pay gas costs in those cases to put stuff on the order book. And that's, you know, an additional fee.
You're paying even before you make a trade sometimes.
Right, right.
And there's,
that's kind of like the trade-off at the moment for decentralized exchanges.
Well, and there is a lot of work going into this.
Yeah.
Part of what you wrote with the 0x protocol, and I actually personally thought that they were already doing this, but it sounds like maybe not. For them to prevent gas costs and stuff going to that, I thought that that was the whole point of them using their own sidechain. And
yeah, I thought the Radar Relay was off chain, but then I listened to the video that DCG did with them last night, and apparently they're not.
It's on chain for now or something.
So yeah. So
so a lot of these have technical things to get over, and for what it's worth, we're talking a decent amount about 0x, but a quick rundown of some of the ones that exist are the 0x project. AirSwap is another one that has a whole different routine. The Republic protocol is one I've never even heard of that Josh, you brought up. The BlockNet protocol, Bancor, and the Bancor network is a whole even different idea. That's more like Shapeshift, that's but decentralized. And then the Waves platform is one of the older ones, I think, that's done done this for a while now. And then Counterparty is another one that I just thought
Counterparty.
Of.
Counterparty, I forgot to put that in the article. Yeah, Counterparty, BitShares, Stellar.
Yeah, BitShares. And really, those are kind of the first to give it a go with this whole thing.
And even like atomic swaps, I think, are going to be eventually where we end up, which are just like, I want to give you 10 LTC for a BTC.
Right.
And that's it, you know, just on-chain type stuff.
Yeah. And several of these people, they're either building all-encompassing, here's our decentralized exchange, and here it's all of our own internal, you know, code and everything else. So you're essentially reliant on the software or the smart contracts that they write, depend, you know, like whatever is at stake there. Those are the things that you're subject to. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I've personally been bullish enough on ZRX to own some, basically since the ICO, I wasn't part of the ICO, but I invested on day one on the exchange, was partially because they're the underlying layer. So they're not, their business model has nothing to do with running one of the decentralized exchanges. So they rely on people like Radar Relay, and there's a dozen others, to use their protocol. And that makes their incentive just to improve the protocol, and they're rewarded as part of their token mechanism, how it all works. But really, it's up to Radar and the other ones that are using it to utilize their APIs and everything else that they're building to create their exchange. So I thought that was really interesting. And most interesting to me was that at least the option exists. The it's part of the design that these relayers can share liquidity. And I think that's really, it's got to be the future, because right now,
I agree,
there's just not enough, you know, they're not,
you can't
just say, well, we have a DEX and it works great, because nobody cares. Like,
right. Those have existed for a long time.
Yeah. And Bittrex is terrible in terms of user interface, but even though they don't have a lot of liquidity, they at least have some.
Yeah, I mean, look what happened with the Polo Bittrex migration.
Yeah,
right. Like, everybody want to trade where
people are trading.
You can trade, as they say, liquidity begets liquidity.
Yeah. So if decentralized exchanges can't create and manage liquidity, then I don't care, basically. And I hate to say that.
Arthur at Bitfinex, BitMEX, is the same way, because he's actually pretty bearish on centralized or decentralized exchanges, based on what I heard him say at Consensus Invest, that, you know, no one trades there, so who cares, basically.
Yeah.
And I completely agree. So until we get liquidity, like we're saying, liquidity pools merging in some fashion, there's not really going to be much going on.
Yeah.
The other thing with the ZRX is there's some sort of governance protocol built in that's decentralized in the effect that it's stakeholders approving or disapproving of changes, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and the reason I like that, and to describe that a little bit, the reason I like that is because if you take one right now, what's the EtherDelta? So if you look at EtherDelta can change their smart contract code, which they've done several times, and anyone integrating it, using it, whatever, they just have to update or not work. So changes to the underlying protocol with all, you know, and you have all these people that are using it, stakeholders and whatnot, building in governance for actually making changes to that stuff is going to make it much more stable in the long term. So I like that. Another angle towards this, so there's the DEX side, and then there's the liquidity side. So Bancor is one of a few projects that is trying to tackle this from a liquidity side of things. And I find it interesting because the way you work with Bancor, to me at least, feels most like Shapeshift than an actual order book style decentralized exchange, because you don't really go in and say, here's what I want to price it at. You just say, mm-hmm. I have, one Ethereum and I want to switch it to Bancor, and you convert and bam, it converts it. And it does so with very little slippage. And I know some people that have used this and been really pleased with how well it works in terms of preventing slippage and essentially bringing liquidity to the table. The difference here is that while it's designed to be decentralized, right now it's essentially based on Bancor's own centralized liquidity mechanisms. And my understanding of that is essentially they're running liquidity like professionals do. And that means that they probably have bots or whatever on every exchange or everywhere else this coin is available, and essentially establishing the trade from that. And then they probably have a tiny markup on what the current price is in order to manage the slippage. That's my understanding of how it might work. Is that wrong or is that right? And you're
in my mind, I have no idea. It's a giant black box that works to me because I have no idea.
Yeah. So the decentralized nature of it is probably a little bit suspect, like it's not super decentralized if it's reliant on all this stuff that they're doing. But again, the future, the plan, the roadmap, every ICO has a great roadmap, would be that it essentially is able to be more and more decentralized as it's built out.
I mean, the dream is you trade off your hardware wallet and you get liquidity of everything in one place, and there's no slippage, fees are minimal. That's the dream for a trader,
Right.
For an exchange, it's a different story, but.
And so what that means is in Radar Relay just released support for this. And I think maybe you could do this somewhere else already, but I don't know. I don't have it up right now. You keep the whole point with the decentralized exchange is like, you don't send it to the exchange. You never send your coins there. So you would plug in your Ledger, your Trezor or whatever, and you would trade right from it. And that's the beauty. And that's got to be the future to me.
It is. And that's the funny thing about the Ether Delta hack. Even though it was a DNS hijack, redirect, phishing attack, whatever, the people who lost their funds were the people who submitted the private keys to Ether Delta.
Yeah.
Based on what I read, I don't know if that's 100% factual, but based on what I read, only the people who submitted private keys, which is an option on Ether Delta, actually lost funds.
Yeah.
So if that doesn't tell you enough about how these things should be operating, I don't know what else will.
Yeah. And that was a case where it wasn't, what happened was not good. But you can,
there's also some questionable, was that an inside job type thing to introduce some conspiracy theories?
Yeah.
Cause I think a group took over, and then very shortly after it was hacked, quote unquote hacked. It just seems weird to me. Mm. Some other things real quick that I didn't get to in the article for ZRX, I don't know if the token itself is going to actually hold value other than who's going to hold it other than people who actually have protocols on top of ZRX to say, have a say in stakeholder type stuff, decision making. So
the idea would be that as it's adopted, that becomes more valuable with a limited token supply.
Yeah. But is that going to,
your point is that.
On paper, that sounds great. Yeah, let's sign me up. But is that going to hold value over time? I don't know. Does it need to hold value over time? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's the type of thing a speculator cares about. Someone like me.
Right.
More so than if you're building off of the protocol itself. I guess there's a reason why the 0x protocol itself would want that, like the 0x team. But if someone's building on 0x, then their business model is going to be based on fees for facilitating the transaction. So
right, because the exchange fees for protocols built on ZRX are completely separate from the relay that getting fees from ZRX itself.
Yeah.
So the relayer charges fees to the user, but then ZRX gives an incentive for the relayers. So it's kind of a separate thing.
Right.
So ideally, the more relayers, the more people getting this token, the more scarce the token becomes, blah, blah, blah. But we'll see. And then the second thing was the KYC AML, which is a perpetual question for any person researching a DEX. There's this utopian dream that if it's a DEX, we don't need to have KYC AML. But as the DCG call illuminated with Radar Relay, you're not going to have big boys coming to the table with their liquidity if the regulators don't trust that the exchange is on the up and up on the KYC AML aspect.
So essentially you may need KYC anyway.
Right. So some sort of identity solutions that's going to be KYC AML in the end, you know, whether that happened in the form of a token, which I'm super bullish and excited about that as well. Identity management mm-hmm. with tokens. I don't think it'll be Civic, but
Civic. I was wondering if you're going to do that.
Civic is an example of an identity solution.
And a lot anyway. Of coins, a lot of projects are coming out with their own identity stuff.
They are, yeah. Because when you think about it, everything you do online is connected to your identity. Everything.
Yeah, there's something eventually will kill passwords and will attach your identity to your device. And that'll be that. We just don't know what that is yet.
Yeah.
One of the other things that I've been reading about and hearing about in interviews was how just because you have this protocol layer doesn't necessarily mean like the decentralized exchange or the relayer, whichever one is actually facilitating the trade, they're still the one that has to manage the a lot of the order book issues that can pop up, like preventing front running or
That's another thing I didn't talk about.
Yeah, or other stuff like that. And
in that article, yeah.
The interview that I listened to, it sounded like that was a real challenge that was hard to think through, and like they don't necessarily know the answer yet. So centralized exchanges have tools in place to help prevent a lot of that, you know, or
they can have tools
or enable depending on how you approach it. But there are a lot of potential concerns, I guess, because your order books or like the fee you associate with the bid. So like say someone says you can buy Ethereum for $1,000 or, you know, 0.1 Bitcoin, and you say, ooh, well, I'm going to offer less, but I'm going to put a greater fee and they'll still take my bid over the other one. So
it's just like the ICO problem with the people like paying huge gas costs just to get in.
Right.
Right.
Right. So
yeah,
those types of questions still exist as well. So
yeah, which is why the Republic protocol, I know nothing about it, but I think that solves that issue, or even AirSwap might, where it's like the order book is cloudy. I don't know, whatever the word
you
is.
Don't,
like,
you don't see the exact order book.
Yeah, it's a fuzzy, they call it a dark pool, which I think is what they mean by that, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, worth reading up on.
Yeah, so there's all these questions. And I think the result that I've had so far in terms of how my thinking changed was just that even though I want this to be a thing, and I want it to be a thing soon, without pretty significant drawbacks, you're not going to have it be a thing very soon.
Yeah. The other thing is it's not easy to use. There's a lot of friction. You have to like escrow your stuff, basically, like mm-hmm. they call it wrapping it on Radar Relay. I think on Ether Delta 2, you have to like put it in a special spot, even though it's on your hardware wallet. I don't fully understand this, but it's called wrapping. So you, I think in a sense, escrow, again, like saying like, this is what's up for trade. And then you can say, you know, I'm putting this on the book or not. So there's another cost on that with Ethereum.
And if it's not on, if it's on the book, then you can't do other things with it for as long as
it's on. So it's kind of like locked up, escrowed, whatever you want to call it in some fashion.
Yeah. I've seen some before where they reward people putting coins on the book.
Yeah, like a maker taker thing.
Yeah. So you're not even from a fee perspective, but you're actually, it's almost like treated like you're staking the native coin. I think it's the Heat Ledger that does this, I think, but I could be wrong. So essentially,
well, that's why Ethanex. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, so if you say like, here's some coins, I'll put them on the order book, and you're establishing liquidity is what you're doing there. Mm-hmm. Then you'll get some of the underlying protocol token given to you over time, just like you're staking a coin, basically.
Yeah.
Which I think is a clever way to get coins on your order book.
For sure. And that's why I have a negative taste in my mouth from Bitfinex, even though I wasn't ever affected by the hack or the debt token or whatever. As much as I dislike Bitfinex, I think their relayer on top of ZRX, which is yet to be released, called ETHFinex.
Yeah, open beta.
Okay. Yeah, it'll be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, decentralized exchanges at the time, if it's even positioning itself as a decentralized exchange. I think it is.
Yeah, it is, and it's one of the things they're bringing to market with theirs, which is a huge power play, is I think they've already figured out, or they're bringing in a way to essentially share liquidity from Bitfinex. So for their coins that are also on Bitfinex, if they are on Fnx, then you'll be able to share the liquidity pool from Bitfinex, which is instantly a mega win.
Yeah. So they have brand power, they have marketing power, they have liquidity. They also are going to introduce another coin called Nectar, which is going to give you a maker incentive. Mm-hmm. So if you put something on the order book, like we were saying, you get this token, and then you can use that token for fees when you, you know, it's not like an ICO or anything, but on the, it's like the BNB coin for Binance.
Yeah.
Where you can use it as part of like your fee payment or whatever. So that's huge. I think that's going to be a game changer. I think all these other relayers are going to fall by the wayside unless they offer something comparable to that for people.
And as much as that's kind of brutal for other business models, it's really what's needed in the end is to have someone just win and be done with it.
Yeah. And you have to incentivize people to make the switch. Because it's not easy to use. I don't know. I haven't used Ethfinex, obviously, but I'm guessing it's from the outset, it's going to be not for everybody, you know?
Yeah. That's our take on decentralized exchanges, at least as much as we know right now. We'll probably have to address this again in 2018, but...
Yeah, I was like, before I did that ZeroX article, I was naively optimistic, but then I got like realistically bullish on the prospect of decentralized exchanges coming to fruition. Within the next 2 years, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think it'll be really good because it's needed. And it is also really interesting in how it'll affect the first half of this conversation, which was just the traditional centralized exchanges. I do think there will always be a place for centralized exchanges. But again, and I've said this before, one of these will come out and just be like, we're going for it. And Bitfinex is kind of doing that with Fnx. And they'll say like, hey, we think DEXs are the future too. Here's how we're going to still have a business model within that world. And I think that has the potential to be very, very powerful as a marketing tool.
Yeah, to see them straddle both sides is definitely interesting.
Yeah.
The decentralized and centralized aspect. And like, so I was listening to this random thing by Jeff Garzik. He was interviewing about his ICO Metronome. And
scam or not
scam? He made a good point. It's complete scam. Okay. Don't, this is an investment advice, blah, blah, blah. But he made a good point with his company Block that a lot of these big companies are looking for enterprise finance solutions where they can ring up a support person and say like, how do I do this? How do I fix this? And you can't necessarily do that if things are 100% decentralized. So he made a good point in that respect that these big companies need somebody to fall back on when they have questions and things.
Yeah. I have thoughts about that. I think if you have standards, cross industry standards, then you can still have someone to fall back on, right?
Yeah, I mean, you either hire a blockchain person for the company to handle this, or you hire a company that has blockchain people to handle this, right?
Yeah.
So those are the two solutions, really. Or everybody's just on the same page all the time, which we're very far from.
That's what we have for now. Do you have a coin of the week?
Yeah, do we talk? I don't think I had one. I don't really have one.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I don't know if I have one right now either. So
alts, you know, in my mind, alts always just look, not always, but right now they look the same. They've hit the 200 on the daily. They're just kind of meandering around sideways, like we said. Mm-hmm. I don't think we'll see anything substantial till mid-March-ish. You know, my thesis on Bitcoin is that the bottom is in for the quarter, especially after March when we get the new quarterly contract / quarterly cycle. So we'll see what happens. But last March is when most of the alts started taking off. If you look at their EMA crosses on the daily for most of these alts last year in March, that was when the bottom turned the corner for most of them anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still discovering bottoms for the most part from what I've seen.
Yep, you can always buy the blood, but it's definitely not a clear trend for most of those.
Yeah, so we'll leave it at that. I would agree with you. I mean, I do think there are better purchasing opportunities now than there were at the end of the year or in January, that kind of stuff, as we've clearly seen downtrends since then. So I don't think if you buy right now, like there's some downwards pressure on some alts for sure that'll continue. But at the same time, if you want to maintain exposure, I don't think it's a terrible time to buy a lot of stuff right now. I'm still exposed to the market, although I'm much more what do you call it, consolidated into fewer positions. And those positions are not necessarily because I think that they're in like the perfect technical setup as much as they're news-based or whatever else. So,
yeah. And I think any alt you buy now is a greater than 30-day hold.
Yeah, yeah.
In my mind, like it's there's nothing significant that's likely going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah. Buying something right now because you want to turn it around in 3 days or 5 days or 7 days, something like that, is probably not the best decision.
Yeah.
Unless you see a specific setup, which go for it. But preserve your capital is what I would say.
That's right.
All right, Josh, it was good talking to you. Where should people check out what you've got going on?
Twitter, YouTube, Brave New Coin, articles, this podcast.
This podcast. It's great to have you back.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to be back.
All right, we'll catch y'all next time. Monuments crumble in the blink of an eye. The easy river just run dry. In a house of cards, I feel the breeze. Wow.